from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Composer, pianist, and musicologist Nolan Gasser says that very few people have ever been hurt to utter the words, "I hate music." But why do we like the music we do? And what draws some to the rhythmic patterns of hip-hop and others to the dense vocal arrangements of a Broadway tune? Gasser, who is the chief architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project, will join us to explain the puzzle of musical preferences and to discuss his new book, Why You Like It: The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. That's all next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Why do we love some musical styles and dislike others? And what does the music we love reveal about our personality? Nolan Gasser sets out to answer those and other questions in his new book, Why You Like It: The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. He was the architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project, which created an algorithm to recommend music for listeners based on the specific characteristics of the songs they played. And his new book draws on psychology, sociology, and musicology to explain the elements that dictate and inform musical preferences. And we're going to talk to him about his work, and we want to hear from you. What musical patterns, styles, or genres move you? And in genotypes, we're talking about pop, rock, jazz, classical, hip-hop, EDM, electric dance music, or world music. Those are generally the categories. And Nolan, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Good to have you here. And I really want to get into this sense because it's always been enigmatic to me why people love certain styles as opposed to others and why they indeed are, what makes them gravitate toward having musical taste of one sort or another. I thought we'd begin by looking at something you bring about in your book. You say that every culture has its own template of musical discourse, from the way melodies are structured to the way rhythms are used, and these broad templates have a strong impact on our tastes, and I can certainly buy that, and they determine what sounds more natural to us. So here's an archetype, and I want to talk with you about this, from the Western tradition. We'll begin there.
Sounds good.
These are elemental, archetypal, right?
Indeed.
This is Mozart's Ein kleine Nachtmusik. All right, they don't have to be classical buffs to recognize that. But talk about the elements of that, Nolan. What influences our taste that are, again, elemental, that are archetypal?
Right, so we come into the world as musical beings. We have evolved to be so sensitive to music's properties in a very complex way, the syntax, the semantic capability, memory as tied to music. And much as with language, we basically, when we're born, we can speak any musical language. So if we're dropped in a small village of India, that musical language, that syntax will become normal for us. Those of us raised in the West, it is obviously the Western tradition. And through many, many centuries, classical music writ large, we come to find normal the tempered scale, this, you know, the seven-note major and minor scales, chord progressions based on the circle of fifths. We may not know these things from a technical standpoint, but they are statistically what our brains have processed as normal. We like repeating patterns. We like certain timbres, you know, so the sound of a trumpet is normal. The sound of, you know, hurdy-gurdy, not as much. So that excerpt from Mozart is tonal music, meaning that it's guided by a harmonic system based on a center key, the tonic, in this case G major. And so Mozart will establish that key, and then through melody and harmonic modulation will go to the dominant degree, which is D major, and then he'll modulate back to home, to G. So we don't need to know these things, but they are part of what is normal for us in music.
We also don't need to know, but it's normal for us, as I learned from your book, and as frankly just validated something that I've observed through the years. You can't understand two or three people talking at the same time, but your brains can actually process two or three or more melodies for that matter, simultaneously. So there's all kinds of cognitive reach here when we're talking about music that we maybe have not even been aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually one of the most fascinating things, the way that our brain can process music on so many levels. Our brain is basically active across so many of the lobes of the brain are activated when we're listening engaged. What you're talking about is actually related to something called auditory scene analysis. So if we think back to our early days as in the caves, when there was a rustling behind us, we needed to know if that was one of our neighbors or a bear. And so our ability to be able to perceive sound, to make sense of sound, to sense where's the direction of sound, and what might it mean for us in terms of survival, is actually related to the importance that music has for us. There is a big question I talk about in the book about whether music was an adaptive trait. So the fact that we can listen to three melodies at once in counterpoint and kind of it makes sense, we can listen to them as a collective and individually, is not by accident. Our brains really have evolved to be able to do that.
And one of the things that's really pleasurable in reading your book is all of that neuroscience and all that brain activity that you spell out that's tied to music. We're talking with Nolan Gasser, who's a composer, a pianist, and musicologist. His book is called Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. He's also the architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project and formerly Pandora's chief musicologist. In other words, if you used Pandora, he's the architect, really, and we'll talk about that as well. But let's first hear some more music. We heard something of the Western tradition or the Western archetype. Here's an example musical template from a non-Western tradition, the Indian raga. And that, of course, is Ravi Shankar, Radha Rasiya. Talk about the elements there and how they dovetail or how they connect or don't connect with what we heard of Mozart.
Well, I mentioned in the Mozart piece, what I focused on was the harmony, the idea of this narrative quality that we're moving from one key center, one set of chords to another. Just in that excerpt, but in really so much of Indian music, it's not about harmonic shift. Really, which is, I think, a surprise maybe to a lot of people, the West is really the only tradition that actually evolved, that developed a robust system of harmony throughout much of the world. It really is melody. So if you think about that, if your main focus is melody, the things that you're going to sort of adjust and play with and toy with are going to be those melodic elements. So the rags of Indian music are, there's hundreds of them. And what it's not just the pitches of the piano. There are pitches between the notes of the piano, the so-called microtones. And if you were raised in India, you are sensitive to those. You can hear those distinctions between one, what we would call a quarter tone or a third tone, and another, and they mean something, and they have emotional impact on us. And so a master like Ravi Shankar can manipulate that. But again, the harmony is really operating in a very static way, what we call a drone. A drone is really another archetype. The West uses drones in every genre, whether it's rock or jazz or classical. But in
also
so much
use
of
them
music,
in the Middle East sometimes too.
Absolutely. So that's one difference.
Well, let's hear yet a third cut, and this is Bessie Smith. Here's an example of American musical language: St. Louis Blues by Empress of the Blues, Bessie Smith. So let's get a contrast again of the elements here as opposed to the other two, Mozart and Ravi Shankar.
Right. Well, from a purely musical standpoint, I mean, obviously there's a lot going on there. From a rhythmic standpoint, we haven't talked much about that. In the Western tradition and in the Mozart example and even in the Indian example, those beats are actually pretty steady, what we would call straight eighth notes. But one thing that jazz introduced comes out of the African tradition are sort of bent rhythms, swing rhythms. So it's normal for us. You know, that example is really part of, I mean, our enculturation as citizens of the States is this fascinating melding between the Western European tradition and the African tradition. Of course, it's at the root of not just jazz, but rock and roll and country music and rhythm and blues. So our sense of what's normal in music is this amazing cross-pollination between these two traditions that found a way of coming together in the form of jazz. And of course, that was Louis Armstrong doing something that is endemic to the African tradition, which is improvisation. And the blues as a genre is all about call and response, right? She does that opening line with this great blues by W.C. Handy, the father of the blues. It has a structure. It's a 12-bar system. One other really cool thing about the blues is to think about that the harmony, it does move from a tonic chord to other chords, but that tonic is not just a major chord, it's a dominant seventh chord, meaning that it has the flat seven, again, coming out of an African tradition. But again, that's something that Mozart would never do. He would never end one of his songs on a dominant seventh chord, but Louis Armstrong would.
Also, think about When the Sun Goes Down, I think of a famous story by William Faulkner. How important are the lyrics?
Well, lyrics are obviously very important. We used to say at Pandora that some people are music people and some are lyrics people.
And some are both.
Some are both. Obviously, we're all both to some degree. Music and lyrics, have a long history together. The whole notion of lyrics meant that it was poetry accompanied by the lyre. So poetry is always meant to be accompanied by music. A good composer will set the lyrics or the text in a way that is complementary most of the times. There are great techniques that a composer can do. If the lyric's about a sort of a mountain, exalted mountain, the melody might go up. So all kinds of ways in which that composer can reflect the lyrics or not. And obviously hip-hop is all about the lyrics.
So even though the cliche would have it that there's no accounting for taste, there is some accounting for taste, even though you can change your taste and you can some people say, I wasn't exposed to that music and I really love it, or I'm really into it now, or whatever. Change things that they were even nurtured on from, early childhood. What makes us drawn to a particular kind? In fact, I want to ask you that question particularly because there's some personal stuff in your book about, we'll get into this. In the book, you actually explain that our musical taste is refined by a host of factors, social class, where we live, those kinds of things. In other words, our subculture. So you have a personal story about a feud you had with a friend of yours, childhood friend, and a good friend, right? Which band was better, Queen or Kiss? You like Queen because you thought the music was sophisticated and technically dazzling, and your friend hated Queen and liked Kiss, finding it fun and authentic. So let's hear a bit from each band, and then we'll get into this whole matter of taste. Here, because you grew up in the same neighborhood.
So absolutely.
Here's Queen's Killer Queen.
She keeps a Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Anthony Cage, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building, a remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At a time, an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well versed in.
All right, now that's my preference too, Nolan. Let's hear your friend's preference. This is Kiss, Detroit Rock City. Because like you, I have very eclectic musical tastes. I can't help thinking of the late Grover Sales, who was a jazz expert and aficionado.
Right.
He used to come on the program and say, how could you like rock and roll? Jazz is so superior. You do hear these kind of arguments, and maybe we can even get into some of that because
sure.
It has nothing to do with taste. He said he would argue jazz is a superior form of music. It has, anybody can understand that. Just listen to it and so forth. But I love rock. You love rock. Talk about the difference between these songs and how that battle that you form with your friend may be indicative of some ongoing impassioned allegiances or battles.
Sure. Well, it might be what Freud called the narcissism of small differences. If you come from a tradition where you don't know the glam rock of the 70s, you might have a hard time even telling too much of the difference. You know, this is a friend of mine in middle school. We shared a lot of taste in common. We both love the Beatles. We love Dr. Demento and Scott Joplin. But in this way, we diverged. We were both pianists. So he obviously was very trained and played Mozart and Chopin as well. So we understood, you know, the levels of complexity that music is capable of. But he found Queen kind of prissy. He liked the...
But forgive me, you can understand the complexity of music. It doesn't mean you... love it or like it, right?
Absolutely. There is not an equation between sophistication and quality. If that were case, then we would all love Stockhausen. Complexity and sophistication and craft are a big part of it. What Grover says, you know, in terms of, jazz is generally a more sophisticated music, but it lacks a certain immediacy, a certain energy that a lot of rock and roll has. Of course, it has to do, as you rightly say, with our upbringing. But that example by Queen, for me, I mean, it's the level of sophistication harmonically, that's worthy of Schumann and some of the progressions there, the use of the background vocals and counterpoint. The Kiss song is obviously more harmonically simple. It repeats the same pattern. The melody is more of an ostinato, sort of a repeating riff, but it has that level of energy that I think that my friend liked, and that was even enough to make him sort of prefer it to Kiss. I mean, both bands are doing well, so we shouldn't feel...
Well, I don't know. They didn't do a movie of Kiss, did they? They did a movie of Queen.
They haven't come out with the movie yet, but they have a whole lot of fans out there.
And what? Tell me, before we go back to taste and questions of taste, connections between Shostakovich and Katy Perry?
Right. Well, some examples are more obvious than others. I think you talked about, the people, who love jazz may think that rock and roll is boring or not worthy. You know, people often put up these sort of barriers around. We all do it. We have our sort of heuristics, our biases.
And snobbery sometimes. I know people won't listen to anything except classical music. They're not open to anything except classical music.
Absolutely. And, and there are some people that think that classical music is, fuddy-duddy and has no relevance for them. And I think that we are all musical beings. Our brains are music processing machines. We have the capability of following the musical narrative across any sort of musical sort of syntax. Obviously,
what you're saying is music is music, right?
Well, depending on our upbringing, it will appear at first as more familiar or more esoteric and exotic. But it's, again, we don't, if somebody were to speak in a foreign language, unless we spend 10 years studying it, we wouldn't be able to get much out of it. But we can actually get something out of music that we've never heard before in that genre. We'll still hear it with an accent. But one of the main purposes in the book, or one of the main goals, is for all of us to think, just because you like Katy Perry doesn't mean you won't like Shostakovich and vice versa. Let's talk about some of the use, maybe it's drones or it's a level of counterpoint or a certain harmonic pivot that's active in both examples that I was talking about. So
there's also a lot of hybridization of music. I mean, there's a lot of, you mentioned Queen before, I mean, they use a lot of classical stuff, Bohemian Rhapsody being obvious example.
Absolutely. Well, Freddie Mercury was, classically trained, and a lot of rock musicians have been. And again, our whole notion of what American music is would not exist without that hybridization between Scottish and Germanic and African and marches and all that stuff that became this gumbo that created the sound of 20th century American music.
Well, let's open our phone lines and find out what music you love and why, and what you think influenced your taste and really move you in the direction you are now in terms of your music preferences or what you really like to hear and like to listen to, go to concerts to, and all that. And any questions you might have for Nolan Gasser, who covers a lot of territory in this book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. It's not only about the science and culture of musical taste. There's also a good deal in there, as I said, about, the brain and how the brain works with music. And I always like what Nietzsche said about music. It's pure form. It's probably the only art that is pure form. Let me invite you to join the program. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Questions and tastes are welcome. Again, you can join us now, 866-733-6786. You can also not only give us a call, but you can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. And we do want you to be involved in the program, so please feel free to do that now. And let's just also talk a little bit about what you call intracultures, because intracultures play a central role in developing taste.
They do, and that is my own term. It's really one of the most fascinating things I got out of writing this book, is to recognize this hinterland between our dominant culture. So we grow up in the West, and we grow up in America. We grow up with that kind of language, and our personality, our own psychology. There is this middle ground which is subculture or community or group or clique or tribe. I use the word intraculture partly because there's so much dispute about every other term, I thought I might as well make my own. So these are the many, many cultures within our dominant culture, and we all belong to hundreds and hundreds. They're based on our geography, our economics, our education, our faith, our ethnicity, and obviously our taste. And what our intracultures can do in such a valuable way is they give us access. So if you get into, if you're Irish American or you're Jewish American or whatever it is, or you grow up in New York and you're in the theater district, you're going to be, what's going to be normal and accessible to you is this wealth of music that if you don't grow up in those, with those kinds of characteristics or in that kind of environment, you won't get access to. Obviously music, with so many subcultures, especially in the rock and the electronica realm, they give, especially youth, a real sense of identity, how they fit in with their peers, how they fit in contradistinction to the broader culture. So what intracultures do to help narrow down that mystery novel of where our musical taste comes from is, I think, a fascinating story. There's a lot of great research out there and some old notions, again, the snobbery, that if you grow up educated and for money, you like classical music and you hate rock and roll, which obviously is hogwash.
Well, we're going to talk more about music. We're also going to hear from our listeners. Steven Pinker calls a lot of this auditory cheesecake. maybe it really is an adaptive trait, as you said earlier, and maybe it's something that we can learn to extend and expand, because our tastes can be so varied and so remarkably diverse. Can't help thinking about, for some reason, Malcolm Gladwell used to say, trust something that comes to your mind immediately.
Sure.
You know? I remember the first time I heard the Righteous Brothers sing You've Lost That Loving Feeling. It was just on a jukebox in a place. And wow, I mean, it just hit me. Music sometimes just does that. It hits you in ways and you don't know why, and it stays with you. It's still that song I still can listen to over and over again. Did a whole program with Grill Marcus, who wrote a book about Bob Dylan's one of his most famous songs, Like a Rolling Stone. And again, just hearing that song the first time, we agreed, hit us in such a strong way. It had such impact on us. Sometimes you don't even know what it's, but you kind of spell all that out and tell us what it maybe is.
I try. It's a lot to spell.
Well, we'll hear more from our listeners and spell out your tastes and any questions or comments you have when we return. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Nolan Gasser with us in studio, composer, pianist, musicologist, and author of Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. He's also the architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project and formerly Pandora's chief musicologist. And we're going to go right to our calls here in a moment. I want to go first to some other music, though. And Nolan also writes about hip-hop. It's another what he calls interculture, subculture, if you prefer, and he discusses it in the book, and in particular, the East-West divide. Boy, we've heard a lot about that, haven't we, in terms of hip-hop? Let's hear just a couple clips. This is first from Dr. Dre's Nothing But a G Thing. All right, keep that in mind, even you snobby only classical music lovers. Let's contrast this with Juicy by Notorious B.I.G.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, rap attack Mr. Magic Molly Mall. I let my tape rock till my tape pop. Smoking weed and bamboo, sipping on.
All right, I think Danny wanted to keep that, both of those playing here. Nolan, talk about what is common here, influences at play.
Right. Well, just to back up, I mean, this is not the music that I grew up with either. And so this was, you know, one of the early genomes for Pandora. And this is really, I was a case study in how we put up these heuristics, these barriers. We sort of define ourselves as, this is not my music. I couldn't possibly like it. So when we had to, you know, obviously get into the world of hip hop, I needed to listen to a whole slew of it. And of course, found all kinds of amazing things. The capability of finding syncopated rhythm in the most creative ways and loops that kind of go against the beat, all these fascinating things. And of course, the stylistic influences. So it can be, again, if this is not your music, you might have a hard time seeing what all the fuss was about between these two styles. But if we
the
really,
East-West styles you're
the
talking
East,
about.
Yeah. So
there were people killing over those styles.
Well, indeed. So there was a lot going on beyond just the music. There was obviously hip-hop is and rap is all about the lyrics. So it's all about, you know, that sense of identity. Both Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, who's also on that song, and Biggie Smalls, you know, has a lot of hip-hop. It's autobiographical. Biographical.
I just found out recently Snoop Dogg was actually named after Snoopy.
That's exactly right.
And Peanuts.
According to his mom, he looked like the Peanuts character. And of course, that was before Snoop's own first album, that Dr. Dre has really brought us so much. Talk about a hit maker. But that style is called, you know, it's called a G thang, right? As in G funk, gangsta funk, that came out in the early 90s on the West Coast, which was in contradistinction and in contrast to what was going on, you know, back in Brooklyn and in Queens and, you know, back East. And it sort of relied on, based on Parliament, you know, funkadelic, George Clinton and all of that. And so much of the bed of the sampled music in that comes out of the funk tradition, like with this song. So the rhythmic language, you can see, is much more laid back behind the beat, especially Snoop Dogg, but also Dr. Dre. It's a little bit more relaxed, as opposed to the Notorious B.I.G. Song Juicy. It's based on an R&B song by James Entume. Much more on top of the beat, a little more rhythmically precise. Many consider him among the sort of the best rappers, just the way he was, again, able to manipulate rhythm. From the outside, maybe not a lot of difference, but when you really get into it, a tremendous amount of nuance there.
I have to tell you, I interviewed George Clinton years ago. He said, "Nice to meet you. I'm the king of funk."
Yeah, and he.
I'm going to go to our callers. Quick listener question, though, and it gets right to the heart of a big question in my mind. He says, "My brother and I are alike in almost everything, but when it comes to music, he's a deadhead. I can't bear to hear them." Mm-hmm. Does DNA have anything to do with our musical taste?
Well, it is it nature or nurture? And as like with most things, of course, it's both. We grow up in a family where we're exposed to certain musical styles of our parents, depending on where, you know, where they grew up, what their influences are. So again, that's going to sound normal. That's going to seed where we're coming from. But as we grow up, and you mentioned hearing the Righteous Brothers, you know, I don't know when that was, but, you know, these songs that we discover, you know, in our youth, in our teens, and in our 20s, they are so important to us because they help have that sort of, you know, that landscape of who we are. Those
what about the melodies that we hear, the lullabies and all that? Things imprinted then too, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's part of the, you know, the debate about if music is an adaptive trait. The fact that every culture has this sort of tradition of motherese, mothers singing their children to sleep and to calm down. Absolutely. But at the end of the day, we discover our own past. So two brothers maybe have probably a lot in common. I'd be surprised if they don't have some things that they share. But The Dead is very much based on these long jams, right? You know, it's they're a jam band. So these long, you know, 20-minute versions of Dark Star, right, where it just seemingly can go on forever, and especially if it's not your thing. But it's about that.
It's a phenomenon that is almost inexplicable, how deadheads can go to concert after concert Same with fish heads now. People go to fish concerts. I mean,
Absolutely. And they
tally them up, and they never get bored. They never get tired, and they just love the music endlessly. Here's Mike, our first caller joining us. Mike, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I've been with you before, Mike Lipskin. I was a record producer at RCA for years, and I've reissued tons of old records, and I've studied the whole the evolution of pop music in America over the past, since 1900.
Wow.
So I have two questions. First of all, I've been wondering how deeply people really listen to and analyze recordings. I do a test where I'll play a simple melody, and I will on purpose end the cadence with the melodic line a half up from what it's supposed to be, which sounds terrible. And I've noticed very often some people will react, some people will not at all, which makes me believe that we all intuitively, unless we're trained musicians, have a varying degree of ability to listen deeply or on what I would call a simplistic level. I don't know whether you agree with that or not. And I have a more important question.
Well, let me go to that, Mike, because it's something that has always fascinated me. There's a story I love by James Baldwin called Sonny's Blues, and it's really part of it is about listening. You know, it's about two brothers again, and one brother says, I really never listened to music, and I never understood my brother until I heard him play and really listened and was taken back, you know, in terms of the spirituals and everything else that music came out of. You had to listen to music, don't you? No.
You know, it's clear that we all have varying degrees of sort of musical intelligence, as we have varying degrees of expertise and innate capabilities in most things. But I really do think we are all, I mean, there's like 4% of the population which have a condition known as amusia, that they actually don't respond to music. But again, just given how deeply wired we are, I think we all have the ability to follow that musical narrative. There's studies by Dan Levitin, for example, which showed that, you know, with songs that people knew, non-musicians, they asked them to sing back a pop song, and they would not only sing it, you sing the right notes, but they would sing it in the right pitch level and at the right tempo. So our brains, through our memory, we have these different categories, episodic memory, where we can remember the specifics as well as the abstract qualities.
Well, you've referenced Oliver Sacks and all those studies about people who are elderly and they
Absolutely.
Have dementia, and yet the words come back to them, the music comes back to them. And Mike, you had another point. Go ahead,
Much
please.
Much more important question, studying the structure of music, to not to take up too much time, even the 60s and 70s, what we called bubblegum music, had quite a bit of structure and production to it on multiple levels. Today's music that young people listen to streaming has 90% of it has two chords, a three-word lyric, layered vocals, because a lot of them can't really technically sing that well. Very, very much more simplistic. I have theories as to why this has happened. And also rap and hip-hop, I would call more poetry, syncopated poetry with a beat rather than what we would call melodic lines.
Well, you but are please. An old record producer, aren't you?
Yeah, well, the sort of demise of music has been, sort of projected for time immemorial. I mean, I think that, again, based on our experience, we can talk about levels of sophistication. I think there would be a lot of people, and especially if you really take a comprehensive survey, you know, pop music by its very nature, part of the, you know, again, part of the mainstream, the superculture, if you will, you know, it even, whether it's the bubblegum pop of the 60s or, you know, the hip hop sort of influence pop or EDM influence pop of today, there's obviously a high production value. The music is, you know, sort of made to be simple so it can be accessible and purchased by a lot of people. But there's, you know, every era has and every genre has its level of sophistication. There's a lot of pop music from the 60s that has two chords back and forth. There's a lot of pop music today that, you know, has looped progressions, but that's because we humans love looped progressions, not just because musicians today are less creative.
Let me thank Mike for the call, and we go right to another call, and that's you, Lynn. Thank you for waiting. Join us.
Yes, this is such an interesting conversation today. I never thought we'd be comparing stories from James Baldwin to music. But my question is, I'm wondering what Noel thinks about pibroch, which is the classical music of the Highland bagpipe, where we take a ground and go through probably six or seven or eight variations on that ground, somewhat similar to Indian ragas. And I'm just wondering if Noel has any insights into that.
Well, you know, sure. Certainly, I mentioned earlier that there are a number of archetypes within music across cultures, and the drone is certainly one of them. The idea of a steady, held pitch, usually it's the lower pitch that is sustained, whether it's in a bagpipe that is actually continuous or in other cultures where it's repeated as a plucked sound. What that enables is creates this stasis upon which change can take place, where the melody shifts, and that just has such powerful emotional capability and communicative ability. You know, music, obviously every culture has a huge body of music that in part acts as its basis of knowledge and its communication. And those songs, those variations, as you talk about for the Scottish bagpipe tradition, those are part of the, you know, the cultural identity. And so those that are versed in that will understand those kinds of nuances. Those communicate different aspects of the history and the culture and the ethics and the personality. And of course, as just pure communication, as we saw in Braveheart, you know, the sound of the bagpipes can rally the troops, as music can do, bring us together. Social cohesion is something that music is able to do as much as anything, and maybe one of the best rationales for music being an adaptive trait. So lots of differences between Indian and Scottish music, but we can certainly talk about some similarities.
Again, we're talking with Nolan Gasser, and his book is called Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Let me thank the caller and go to some comments that are coming in here. Hope writes, for me, lyrics are what draws me to music most. A lyric combined with a melody that makes me feel understood. My partner rarely listens to lyrics and seems to value it for its melodic value only. Why do you think some prefer one over the other? What different functions do these aspects play?
Well, that may be a sort of beyond my own pay grade. You know, I early in the book, I talk about melody. What I do in the book, just to back up a little bit, I sort of break it up between these musical chapters. I break down each musical parameter: melody, harmony, rhythm, form, and sound. And then I continue on with these different what I call genotypes: pop, rock, jazz, hip-hop, electronica, world, and classical. But interseated in those are these extra musical discussions, which really get to the heart of where does our musical taste come from through evolution and neuroscience and sociology and psychology. And so in the melody chapter, I kind of give a disclaimer that I'm not talking much about the lyrics because it would be another book. It's poetics. And you're right. As we used to joke about, there's the world can almost be divided into people that, you know, think that the lyrics are more important than the music, or vice versa.
But so either the music or the lyrics, the poetry, as you call it, can affect us in completely different ways. I mean, and have an impact on us in a completely different way. And so when you combine the two, that's really getting a kind of dual hit.
Well, it is. I mean, obviously, language is the most direct form of communication. That's really, you know, it is the more advanced form of communication, but so is music. Music communicates. So when you have this communicative medium of lyrics or poetry wrapped in this sonic communication language, generally speaking, the music will appropriately accompany the lyrics to support it. If it's angry lyrics, then the music will probably be aggressive. If it's sweet, you know, wooing lyrics, then the music will probably have that quality. Of course, composers can do what they want, and sometimes there's contrast, but that's when you put them together, it's a double wallop.
Do you know about Gloomy Sunday?
Absolutely.
No, the reason I ask is, it's just for listeners who aren't aware of this, hundreds were driven to suicide just by the lyrics of a song, of a composition, I should say, That was quite...
Billie Holiday, right?
Yeah, Billie Holiday did a form of it, but that was even before it was Hungary and Germany mainly. Mm. And there was a movie made of it. In fact, it's the effect of it called Gloomy Sunday in Europe. I think about it because music can bring us down. You know, the blues can do both. It can elevate us. It can make us happy. It can make us euphoric even at the same time that, you know, it's like The Sorrows of Young Werther by Goethe. There were people killing themselves because they read this novel. They were doing the same thing with Gloomy Sunday, the musical composition. I mean, the effect of music is just so extraordinary. And I know I want to hear something from you because I know you've been working at Sloan Kettering, working with cancer patients and particularly people who have been suffering from depression and anxiety. Working in a kind of Pandora way with music to lighten and heighten their spirits, yeah?
Right. So certainly one of the great motivations to write this book and really for myself as a composer and performer is just to, you know, celebrate that power that music has over us. And I do in the epilogue, I talk about music therapy and the long tradition of the connection between music and the body, which was known to the ancients and is now scientifically validated. So, I mean, music is well documented as much as 10 milligrams of morphine equivalent to for those that are suffering from the effects of chemotherapy. If you listen to music in a regimented way, in a careful, again, that's coming back to the earlier caller, if you're really engaged in the listening process, you follow the music in its own time. We don't have to do that. Music is great when it's just background or we're casually listening. But when we're really engaged, when we're inside the musical narrative, our brain is operating, it lowers our heart rate, our blood pressure.
And changes moods.
Changes our mood. And even sad music. There's this notion of the paradox of negative emotion or negative music, where actually the hormones are released when we hear sad music. Prolactin, which is the same hormone that's released, when mothers nurse or after sex. So it's this kind of Aristotelian sort of catharsis that it's sad. I mean, obviously, in the case of Gloomy Sunday, it did turn tragic. But oftentimes we hear the blues or we hear sad music, and there's kind of a paradoxical good feeling.
Well, the blues is like that, I think. Natasha asks, what do you think about people who can't hear music? We're back to that again. I know at least one person like that, and she doesn't care for any music whatsoever. She can't hear it, doesn't understand it, and I just don't comprehend that myself, being a music lover. How can that be?
Well, it's obviously, it is a tragedy to not be able to have the full capability of hearing music in that way. But there actually are a lot of deaf, listeners and musicians that have a very differing sort of opinion. There's a famous percussionist, Evelyn Glennie, who is deaf, but is actually one of the world's most sought after percussionists. She feels those because pitch is frequency. It's vibrations of sound waves. We all know that when our cars vibrate, when we're stuck in traffic next to a car playing hip hop, maybe. So music can be felt in the body, but obviously there are certain nuances that sadly a deaf person will not hear.
Well, I want to hear from some more listeners, but first I want to hear some more music and have listeners hear some more music. You also write about particular musical elements that define musical taste and transcend genre. For example, for people with a taste for complex or chromatic harmony, as opposed to the last caller, listener who said don't like music at all, they may find something to appreciate in all of these songs. Let's just hear some cuts. First, the Beatles, Sexy Sadie.
Sexy Sadie, what have you done?
All right, keep that in mind, Beatles lovers or those who don't love the Beatles, and let's hear something of Giant Steps, John Coltrane. And to just go through this tripartite, here's Arnold Schoenberg, piano pieces, Op. 1, number 1. The Tell us, Nolan, what do these have in common?
One of these is not like the other. Well, those are all examples of harmonic sophistication, chromaticism, as is technically noted, the idea of shifting around from chord to chord or from one key center to another, not in a simple way, as we heard maybe in the Mozart example of going from the tonic to the dominant, from the one to the five, but that Beatles song, for example, goes down chromatically from a G major to an F sharp major. The Giant Steps is really one of the most sophisticated harmonic jazz songs. You know, famously, Tommy Flanagan, who was supposed to be McCoy Tyner playing that solo, but that was so sophisticated that he kind of didn't know how to approach it. And of course, Schoenberg is a breakdown entirely of the tonal system into atonality. The point, I guess, is that, you know, music operates on many, many levels, including the harmonic one. And if we are predisposed to have a penchant for chromaticism in one realm, there's a good likelihood, if we listen to it carefully and we follow it, that we will find that that love in another. It also, to me, one of the most interesting aspects of the quest for figuring out where our taste for music comes from is actually in the physics of sound and the way that we humans have manipulated those properties. The whole notion of going from a G major to an F sharp major chord right next to each other. If you had done that, tried to do that back in the Middle Ages, everybody would run for the hills because the systems of tunings didn't even allow for it. So you couldn't even appreciate a complex modulation like that. So our own taste collectively and individually is a product of things that, you know, most of us don't think about, including the way that physicists have worked with overtones and things like that.
We've got a rather long discourse here from a listener about Pandora, but I think it's worth reading nevertheless.
Okay.
Just prepare yourself for this.
All right.
Rob writes, the tech industry has given us access to more information than we have ever had, yet their algorithms expose us to less and less thoughts, music, and images every day. All of the great music forms have come from an interplay between disparate cultures and traditions. The Pandora algorithm claims to break down specific elements of a song or artist and produce more songs that contain those elements. With all that forms of music have in common, that should produce tunes from various years, genres, and races. In actuality, it rarely strays from any of these categories. Consider Prince, who had musical influences from Joni Mitchell and Sly Stone. The Prince station almost exclusively plays 80s synth-driven black pop. Carole King had a long career as a songwriter for black soul groups and artists, yet Pandora categorizes her as mellow rock or folk influences, i.e. entirely white. We lament every day about increased polarization in America as the Internet collates what we see and hear, guided solely by providing us with as close as the algorithm can determine that we have seen and heard before. The mind atrophies, our ideas get entrenched instead of expanding, and we are all dumber up for it.
Oops. Sorry about that. I actually have an op-ed coming out in the LA Times addressing some of these issues. Obviously, I am not a spokesperson for Pandora and haven't worked at the company for several years, so I can't. It's not really my position to kind of defend the.
But let's cut to the chase here. Are our tastes being too kind of homogenized and
right.
connected in ways that don't necessarily serve us for expanding?
Yeah. Well, certainly there is the capability that. That the Music Genome Project has, if it were just, you know, an isolated technology away from commerce, that would be able to, you know, cross genres, cross styles, to find where you could go from Prince to jazz and even to, music in other cultures, to find those, as we've been talking about. You're absolutely right. And actually, sort of a notion of a trans species genome is something I would love to see at Pandora, where a user could actually indicate that.
I've got another listener who asked, let me just go to the chase on this again. Yeah. Do algorithms limit people from exploring what we may like?
Well, I mean, I think there's, you know, Pandora, again, is a business. And so there's one thing that, you know, the folks at Pandora will tell you is they have, you know, big data. So they have billions and billions of thumbs up and thumbs down data. So if you create a print station, you know, in the abstract, there's all kinds of music, you know, based, which is really one of the main goals of the Music Genome Project, is to base it really on what's intrinsic to the music itself. But obviously there is other kinds of machine learning where, you know, through the taste of millions of other listeners, if you like this song, there's a good chance you will. You have the right to say thumbs down.
I have Sirius, and I have to tell you that there's now a Beatles channel on Sirius, there's a Springsteen channel on Sirius, and there's also an Elvis channel on Sirius. And these are all musical forms that I like and enjoy. But right. They have done so much that there's a lot of stuff that I just have no interest in. I mean, not only no interest in, but I don't like it. By those performers, you know, I mean, I can tell you many songs by all of those performers that I really like. But then they have all these obscure songs and all these performances that, you know, they were doing things that perhaps weren't in their best interest. I know, it's just fascinating, and this has been a fascinating discussion. I wish I could go to all the comments and all the callers, but we've come to the end of the hour.
Oh, okay.
So thank you so much for being with us. Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste, Nolan Gasser's book. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And let's talk about who's behind the scenes here. KQED Forum, produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Ariana Prale. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Funt. Interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Craig.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.